2 years, one of my very good friends was getting married. And he began to plan his wedding, like most people do. It's a long process of lining up a reception hall, lining up a place to get married. And one of the many steps in the wedding process, of course, is putting together the bridal party. And this is something that has to be done with great sensitivity because, of course, your bridal party, in a way, kind of happens to sort of rank the people in your life that are closest to you. There's kind of no way around it, and some people try to have maybe two best men or have a huge bridal party, and sometimes you can get away with this. But this is a very old tradition where you ask the people that have been closest to you, your closest friends, perhaps brothers, sisters, cousins, to stand up in your wedding is what we say. And so my friend was planning his wedding, and he kind of went through the list of those men that were closest to him that he wanted to stand up in his wedding. And he kind of set down the list. He chose his best man, and then he went through, and he came up with the other guys that he wanted to call. And he called his best man and asked him, and he said yes. You know, he's very honored. And then he kind of was going through the line, and he got to one of the last guys that would be kind of standing out on the end. And he called him, and he said, "Hey, Aaron, I want to know if you would be willing to stand up in my wedding." And Aaron, you know, started to respond appropriately. He said, "Oh, of course, that would be such a great honor. You know, that would be a huge honor to me." And then he said something kind of strange. He said something intentionally to kind of throw my other friend off, the one that was getting married. He said to him, "Yeah, standing up in your wedding, that would be a great honor." And then he said, "Can I be the best man?" And the guy who's getting married kind of was taken aback a little bit. And you know, what do you say to that? "Can I be your best man?" And he knew this other friend well enough that he kind of laughed it off and said, "No, of course not, Aaron. You can't be my best man." But the story shows a certain presumptuousness, a certain audacity that reminds me of the story here of James and John with Jesus. James and John, in this journey, these chapters of Jesus' journey to Jerusalem, the disciples are traveling with Jesus, and the story begins by saying that James and John kind of seem to go ahead, move forward to him, and say to him, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you." Interesting requests by these two brothers. It's almost as if they know that there's something a little bit off about their next question to Jesus. They want this sort of blank check that Jesus will agree before they even ask the question so that they can be sure that they get what they're asking for. And Jesus wisely responds very tactfully, "Well, what is it that you want me to do for you? Grant us to sit one at your right hand and one at your left in your glory." It's almost as saying, "Can we be your best men?" And it's very easy to pick on James and John here. It's very easy to look at them and to say, "What audacity, how can they do this, you know?" And certainly the other 10 respond with anger when they heard about this request from the brothers. And yet there's something about the request that's not necessarily all bad. I mean, the bad parts are there. You know, we can pick on them and kind of look down on them in this condescending way and say some things like, "I would never approach God so audaciously, so self-servingly." Or we can wonder, "How can these two be so thick-skulled as to not understand everything that Jesus had said to them about suffering and servanthood and the nature of his way?" Again, this comes right after the section on the crucifixion. You know, we can look at them critically and say, "How are they just not getting it? How can they be so audacious?" We can also wonder, have they not known Jesus long enough to see that his path is about being made low, not being lifted up? You know, it's almost like you just want to be like, "Don't you guys get it? You know, you're asking to be exalted, lifted up, have your own sort of self-serving glory satisfied. You're kind of missing the whole point of what Jesus has been teaching about laying down your life, about serving others." And so there are certainly things to be critical about with these two. But likely the requests of these two brothers is mixed in their motives. There are good things in this too. Notice that the fact that they ask this question represents that they have at least faith that Jesus will be exalted as king. That part of it they understand. They really believe that Jesus is on his way to Jerusalem as the Messiah and will be in some sense exalted to some status of kingship, of glory. So there are parts of it where they have faith, you know, they trust. It also shows a desire to rule with Jesus in his work. What do I mean by that? This language of, can we sit on your right and on your left, is language of royalty. It's the language of the throne. The throne here is implied, that Jesus will be lifted up on some sort of throne. And in a sense, there is a righteous plea here for them to want to rule with him in his work. In a sense, you can say that they're eager, they're zealous to participate in the reign of Christ. And certainly that's a good thing. And of course, we should note too that in their request, Jesus still remains the center. They're not trying to usurp Jesus and make themselves the absolute center. They want to honor Jesus. They just want to honor Jesus in a way that very much honors themselves as well. And so if we are going to be fair to James and John here, we should recognize that their desire to be seated closest to Christ in his glory is an ambition of mixed motives. On the one hand, they want to serve their king as true king, but the path that they were choosing, on the other hand, is one that ultimately remained about them. And those of you tonight who are keen listeners can perhaps predict where I'm going next with this. I said before, it's easy for us to be condescending and look at James and John and be so critical of their audacity. But when we kind of move closer and see the very mixed motives of their service to God, of their faith, they end up not looking too unlike ourselves. This is the point at which the distance between James and John and us today begins to shrink. Is it possible that even a devout Christian, even those of us who are busy volunteers, those of us who are church leaders, those of us who are even pastors, could, after all, perhaps even us, follow Jesus with mixed motives? Within any Christian culture, there will always exist endless opportunities to acquire status, respect, honor, and even fame for one's selfless Christian service. I mean, think about this for a moment. Because this is something that is very important for us to be aware of, this mixed motive nature in us. On the one hand, wanting to faithfully follow Christ and exalt him as king, but on the other hand, very much seeking our own acquiring of status, of honor, of glory in the midst of our service. Our service isn't as pure as we'd like to think it is. Especially in this context of Grand Rapids, I mean, Grand Rapids is very much a city that has a heavy Christian influence, and many Christians are here. And it's easy for those of us in very busy, active church cultures to serve for our own glory. And I think of things like social justice and the things that we do to be faithful people, and the social capital that sort of comes with that implicitly. You know, I see this in my own life. I see this, you know, I'm starting to kind of catch on to the idea to the good ethical benefits of shopping locally, of eating organic food, as opposed to kind of a fast food culture and all the unethical things about that. And I'm very keen to the fact that in some social groups of some of my friends, quite a bit of social capital comes with this talk of you know, this is what I'm eating. Oh, look at my food. It's organic. Or, oh, like, where did you buy that? You know? And it's very important for us to be aware of this, you know? I can have my Sojourners magazine about social activism kind of sitting out in the perfect place for someone to sort of recognize it and say, oh, wow, Tony's such a good Christian. He's serving. He's doing all these things. Or, you know, I can be motivated more to buy an environmental car like a Prius. My motivation could be more about what people would think about me than caring about the environment itself. I mean, hopefully that's a part of it as well, is caring for the environment itself. And hopefully that's the majority of it. But let's be honest, often we have very mixed motives with these things. It's interesting, too, if you think about leadership in ministry, being asked to serve your church, perhaps as the chair of a committee, as a deacon, as an elder. I mean, each of these positions are, in many ways, a position of upward mobility in church life, right? I mean, they change the way that people see us. They come with status. They come with some exaltation of ourself, of our own making our name great. And these can be real temptations. I mean, at least James and John were explicit about their ambitions. And we need to also at least recognize the mixed nature of our ambitions. For us to be unaware of the temptations and risks here is hazardous to the well-being of our souls. We must be awake to the truth that the Christian life itself can easily become just one more self-serving strategy toward power, status, and honor. Even our service itself can be done to exalt ourselves more than the other. And so we are, in fact, not as much unlike James and John as we would like to be. And the other 10 in the story are by no means saints either. Commentators sort of wrestle with this idea, you know, is there anger towards these two brothers, righteous anger or not? And most of them say, no, it's not righteous. They're not angry because they're frustrated that these two disciples still don't get it. They're angry because these two tried to cut in ahead of them, and they have the same sort of competitive spirit to want to be first and greatest themselves. And so all the disciples then, and in some ways all of us now, still struggle with this. And so this is the moment that Jesus speaks into. And like a good teacher, Jesus seizes this moment as the perfect time for a lesson to his followers. And so verse 42 starts with this language of Jesus calling them. He gathers his struggling disciples in, and he says to them, "You know that among the Gentiles, those whom they recognize as their rulers lord it over them, and their great ones are tyrants over them. But it is not so among you. But whoever wishes to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wishes to be first among you must be slave of all. For the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many." Jesus is saying to them all, you still don't get it. This is not the way, the way of ambition, the way of competitiveness, the way of power, the way of upward mobility. This is not the way. Ambition to exalt yourself may be the way of the world, but it is not so among you. And the Greek here is interesting because it's not this future tense, it shall not be this way among you. He says, it is not this way among you. It is not so among you. The very nature of the kingdom as it is, as we exist in it, is contrary to the way of the ambitious self-gratification. Jesus is saying to them, in the kingdom, things are upside down. You want to become great? Then become a servant. You want to be first rank among all people? Then you have to become the absolute lowest. And the language here gets even stronger. The second time, he doesn't just say servant. He uses the Greek word for slave, the very lowest. You want to be first rank among people? You have to become slave of all. Not even just a servant, slave of all, for this is the way of God. And Jesus is certainly gentle here with his slow-to-learn followers. As he was with them, he is with us today. But he also makes very clear that the part of their faith that is guided by self-serving ambition is at odds with the path he has called them to, the path of the servant. The way of Jesus is not one of self-service, but service to others. The way of the world is power, but the way of God is humility. God's economy moves downward, not upward. And so these words cause me to stand back and to sort of examine myself. And I invite you also to examine yourself. How are we doing at sifting through our mixed motives and learning to become people who are truly servants because we want to follow Christ and not just to bring glory to ourselves? And the clearest test to figuring out what our true motives is, found in those moments when we are asked to serve, where no glory for self is possible. In these times when we have nothing to gain for ourselves. This of course, brought to mind to me all the times where Jesus talks about going to a secret place. You know, he talks about the benefits of going to pray alone. And he contrasts that with the Pharisees who are out in public or the people who put oil on their head and fast, you know. Jesus' teachings about being quiet about your fasting practices or about your tithing practices. There's something happens when we serve in that secret place where nobody else sees and no one else will know about it. A few examples of this. I think of encounters with strangers in lines at grocery stores, or anytime you're out in public and people don't know who you are, it can almost be a sort of free license to act however you want because nothing about your own name is at stake, right? So I was thinking of this last week. I was driving to Culver's and I was in a hurry because I wanted to get back to the church to work on my sermon. And this, you know, I'm kind of coming up to the drive-thru, and this other car was coming at, and I kind of sped up to get in front of the other car. And thinking about the difference between something like that where, you know, the person's not going to know who I am, they're never going to meet me, nobody's going to know about it, unless I confess it to all of you in a sermon, of course. But the difference between that and perhaps being at a church dinner where I'll have my name tag on as a pastor and I'll, oh, you go first, go ahead, get in line for food. It's much easier to serve when people are going to see that, right? So what are my real motives there? Money, of course, is a huge indicator of this. When we give and know that no one will know that we have given, and it can be hard sometimes to kind of keep our mouth shut about this and to not say, oh, yeah, I gave $100 to that, or I donate to this organization or that. But to really give, and like Jesus says, you know, not let your other hand know what the one hand is up to. To do that in a way that we make sure that it's really not about us, but it's about serving itself, serving God. Or another example is when we become, is when we are faithful in ministry when it yields very little results. I'm thinking specifically of sometimes when a friend might come to you and need someone to talk to. And that one's tricky because, of course, there's a certain kind of self-gratification that comes from being the helper, right? But situations where you are serving in some sort of ministry setting and just putting so much energy into something that nobody will ever see, where the effects aren't some huge, great, you know, hundreds of souls being saved or the community being restored. But when you continue to plod along, faithfully serving God, even when the results of that faithfulness are not huge and glorious and something to celebrate, God is working in that. God does something in that secret place that is a part of the hiddenness of his kingdom. I was talking to a friend about that, and they shared with me an organization that they were a part of that worked in the inner city, and they would go around knocking on people's doors and asking if they could pray for them. And there was one woman that they had a relationship with that had these walls up, and they prayed for her for something like 6 years, continued to try to visit her, and she would kind of rudely, you know, ask them to leave and get impatient and frustrated. But eventually, after 6 years, finally those walls broke down, and they had some amazing conversations with this woman and were able to share the gospel with her. And that's just a picture of the way that the kingdom works, that upside-down nature of sometimes it just, the work of God is secret and subtle and has little to show for it. And it's not that our work is illegitimate if our motives are not pure. You know, I think of Paul's words in 1 Corinthians where he confesses that in our ministries we have these impure motives. And he even goes out of his way to say that even still, God works through this. So I don't want to freak anyone out to make you think that your work is somehow illegitimate if a big part of it is your own self-glorification. But Jesus' words can be seen as a form of mercy here, because we who remain trapped in serving ourselves are the ones who are really robbed from all the benefits of the way of Christ. We ourselves who seek our own glory are the victims of our own ambition. Because in choosing self-aggrandizement, we are choosing the path that is ultimately vain, shallow, and empty. And I think we can all relate to that, to know that there's something so unsatisfying about the competition to outserve each other, outdo each other, or to be more holy or socially conscious or a better, humbler person. That path is empty. And so Christ's words to us here are really an invitation to follow his path of suffering for the sake of another. It is actually a form of his mercy to us, because self-serving ambition misses the way of the cross and actually blocks us from Christ's path to glory. Because Christ invites us to enter the way of the cross, to choose servanthood, to die to ourselves, because he desires for us to experience the abundance of life that exists on the other end of that death. So let me kind of phrase that a different way. Think of it this way. If our service never becomes anything more than that self-interested mask, you know, a fake sort of, or at least mixed sort of serving God, but really we're doing it to serve ourselves. If we never move beyond that, do we ever really experience the death of laying down our lives that Jesus talks about? Think about that. If we never move out of that to a real service that's not about us ultimately, do we ever really experience the death that comes in following Jesus? And if we never really die, are we really experiencing the fruit of risen life that is found on the other side of that death? There's a lot packed in there. What I'm trying to say is that to really lay down our lives for Christ certainly involves suffering. I mean, Jesus uses this language of this cup that I will take up, this suffering that he's spoken about. There's a very real suffering that comes in laying down our lives to follow Christ. But at the other end of that is, of course, resurrection. We follow Christ, and death is not the last story. We follow Christ, and we lay down our lives. But, of course, the story doesn't end there. We are resurrected with Jesus Christ. And to really lay down our lives in service opens up for us that possibility of truly experiencing the joy, the fullness of life that comes from the resurrection to follow. And I think the experience of that in this side of life comes in part in the joy that is the opposite of that shallowness that I spoke about. There is a certain joy, a certain satisfaction when you serve someone and nobody will know about it. When you put that money in the offering plate and know that that's just between you and God, and it is a gift that God gave to you that you give back to God, and you can celebrate that with a satisfaction that we don't find when we draw attention to it and invite glory on ourselves. And certainly we can see this joy, this life, abundance of life, most fully on a communal level. If we look at not just the individual, but if we look at what our lives look like as a full community when we live out this true servanthood, this true laying down our lives for one another, as opposed to the false competitive sort of positioning to be the greatest Christian, the holiest, the greatest among each other. When we really live this life of foot washing, this life of giving, of letting go of our own status, we are all the better for it. We experience a communal joy and wholeness that we don't have without it. Some theologians talk about this as Jesus inviting us into an alternative society. Jesus saying, follow me, follow the way of the servant, is Jesus saying, come and know the life of the kingdom, the alternative society where even the meek, the humble, those who are suffering, all are welcome to come and be near to me and experience life to the fullest. This is a form of great mercy that God invites us into the life of his very being. The last line, Jesus says, you know, he gives us instruction and says, whoever wishes to be first among you must be slave of all. And then he ends with verse 45, for the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many. Jesus does not just give us a principle to follow. He gives us his very way of life. He gives us himself. He is the one who lays down his life on the cross to serve all of us by offering himself as a ransom for our sin. What an ironic picture that ends up being when you think about the image of Jesus on the cross, James and John asking to be on his right and on his left, not knowing that to be on Christ's right and on his left is to be alongside Jesus in suffering. I mean, the two crosses of the criminals are obviously a very vivid picture of that. But Jesus is saying, you know, if you want to follow me, this is the way that it has to be, death and resurrection.